you're knocking on the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station. You're listening to the coolest station in Montreal, 90.3 FM on your dial. The alternative station, the one that gives you a choice and a voice. CKUT. Stay tuned.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Good evening and welcome. I am happy to be here on behalf of Haymarket Books to be in conversation with Mark Lamont Hill and Mitchell Plitnick, co-authors of this critical new text, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. And so before I give you the bios for these gentlemen and dig into, dive into questions, I should say, let me start by sharing my own stories of interacting with this concept of progressive Except for Palestine, what's otherwise known as PEP. Many encounters, but one of the most vivid ones was in around 2001, when I was working with a group of remarkable women who were trailblazing and continue to trailblaze in the field of critical feminism and anti-racism, Nadine Nabir, Iman Dasui, Lina Baroudi, and Yumna Shlele, who I supported. I was a researcher in supporting the effort to draft a paper entitled The Forgotten Ism, an Arab American Woman's Perspective on Zionism, Racism, and Sexism. That paper was to be presented in Durban, South Africa, during the 2001 Durban Review Conference, which was basically a review of the decade against racism, the first convening of it happens in Ghana in 1978. And so it's at this time in 2001, it's in the beginning, in the aftermath of what's known as the Second Palestinian Intifada. It's obvious that the peace process has collapsed. Yasser Arafat is about to be held hostage in his own presidential compound. The Israeli military has now shifted from an occupation framework and law enforcement to direct military force against Palestinians who are in protest. And in this context, what crystallizes is that this isn't about peacemaking, right? This is actually about dismantling a racially informed, right, if not racist, system that's predicated and based on an imbalance of power between a state Israel, a nuclear power, the 11th most significant military in the world, and a stateless people, the Palestinians. And so from this crystallizes a framework, or I should say, again, it's a return, an analytical return to understanding that Israel is actually overseeing a racist regime. And as people are going to Durban, South Africa, they're intent on holding up the banner that Israel is an apartheid state, right? This causes all, it's global grassroots coalitions that are doing it. There's no state that's actually leading this effort, unlike the earlier effort in 1975, when that was, you know, in agreement amongst the third world countries and the non-aligned movement. But this causes such an uproar, right? That Israel says, this is anti-Semitic. We're pulling out of the entire Durban Review. The United States is indignant and believes that not only is it anti-Semitic, but it's threatened to pull out as well. And what Naomi Klein later shows us, in an excellent Harper's Essays on this topic, is that the United States was using Israel to protect itself because it was going to be held to account for reparations for people of African descent in the United States. And so they're withdrawing to protect themselves, but they're using the critique of Israel as an apartheid state as the shield and the entry point. So here we see in this moment something that is actually endemic to working on Palestine within progressive spaces. You can imagine the amount of consternation that this causes and the split that this causes even within the progressive ranks at Durban, who agreed with the analysis, but were very bitter that all of their efforts to hold racism to account globally were about to be undermined because of the insistence that Israel was racist too, right? And so it became the back door to unravel these progressive efforts. And even though everyone can see it for what it is, it creates this split. Now that is what I'm describing as endemic. That was also the case, and I was just telling my friends here that I'm working on a piece that's revisiting this history when it happened in 1975. The same thing happened during the deliberations of the Decade for Action, that the threat to undermine the entire decade for any mention of Zionism would then dismantle the entire project. And we also see the contemporary echoes. Obviously, we saw it clearly during the Women's March, when the inclusion of a critique of Zionism from, you know, a radical feminist critique of Zionism becomes a thread to unravel the Women's March. It becomes a personal attack against Linda Sarsour and a vicious personal attack against Resmi Yaudeh when she joins in basically calling for a national strike amongst women. We see it again as it targets individuals who are doing this work, like when Dr. Angela Davis, a daughter of Birmingham, an icon of human rights and intersectional advocacy, right, is going to be awarded the Shuttlesworth Human Rights Award in Birmingham, but that award gets rescinded because of her stance on Palestine. We see it happen to Dr. Hill, who was also punished in response to his speech at the United Nations, and then summarily fired as a CNN commentator in response and his punishment. We're seeing it right now play out with Dr. Cornel West in his battle for tenure at Harvard because of his position on Palestine, which is even, I think, much less radical than the ones that, you know, have been at issue, that have taken, you know, that have actually taken a direct target at Zionism or taken issue with Zionism. And of course, I can't say all this without saying that the greatest, right, that the folks who have endured this the most have been Palestinians themselves, as we've seen in the case of Professor Stephen Salaita, as we've seen in the case of Professor Joseph Massad or Professor Nadia Abulhaj, that the greatest punishment is reserved for Palestinians. And oftentimes it happens in ways that are much more consequential, as was the case with the Los Angeles 8, right? That spanned, it was a 20-year witch hunt that threatened to rescind Palestinians of their American citizenship because of their advocacy for Palestine, as well as in the case of the Holy Land Foundation, where their support of Palestine has been criminalized as somehow supporting terrorists. I mean, this is, This isn't just about the limits of progressive politics. What's at issue is that there is an accusation and the risk of bearing an accusation by taking a stance on the question of Palestine and a stance with Palestinian human rights. So I want to ask our co-authors to tell us about that accusation. Let me briefly introduce them. Here's their beautiful new book. You too can read their bio in the back cover and see their fancy picture. Mark Lamont Hill is an award-winning journalist and Steve Charles Professor of Media, Cities, and Solutions at Temple University. He is the author of multiple books, including the New York Times bestselling Nobody. He lives in Philadelphia. Mitchell Plitnick, the president of Rethinking Foreign Policy, is a political analyst and a frequent writer on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy. His past roles include vice president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, director of the U.S. Office of Beit Salem, and co-director of Jewish Voice for Peace. He lives in Maryland. Welcome, gentlemen. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So tell us. Tell us about it. You all describe, you know, in multiple vignettes in different spaces from within Congress. I think you focus on Congress, but also in media spaces and elsewhere on what you describe as a limit amongst progressives. And yet here I'm saying I think it's also an accusation. And in particular, you're focusing on the brand of this limit in the United States. So can you tell us what is this limit? How, if you were to erect a model of how this limit and the barrier to touching the question of Palestine gets constructed, how would you describe it to somebody who's down and entering grassroots movement and doesn't think a thing of it? For them, Palestine is just part of the big picture, and you want to tell them, well, there's this thing. How then would you answer that for them?
That's a wonderful, challenging. That question is so interesting and challenging. I almost want to just pass it to Mitchell and hi. I think that it's a great question, because I think that part of what we attempt to do in the book, and part of what we've, how we came, let me back up actually, part of how we came to this book and came to this topic for a book was that we were trying to figure out where our intervention could be. Right. We started writing this book a few years ago before I still worked at CNN when we were writing this, when we started this book. So in some ways, we were trying to figure out how we could initially offer a critique of the rising tide of authoritarianism in the United States and in Israel. We were looking at Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu as two kind of emblematic figures of a rightward shift in politics. And we were trying to think about how those two things were connected. That's where we actually began our project. And then things got more interesting. Things got more interesting in the political sphere. Things got more interesting in our personal lives. Things got more interesting in our conversations. And we said, what could be an even more interesting intervention for us to make as non-Palestinians, as non-Israelis, as American citizens, taxpayers, et cetera. And we said we wanted to touch on this question of the PEP and what it means to be one. But we didn't want to have some kind of psychoanalysis of the PEP. You know, it didn't want to just be some kind of critique of those people who have these ostensible or apparent contradictions morally, ethically, politically, although that's interesting. I think that's in some ways well-trod territory. And we also didn't want to reify the PEP. It was really important to me and Mitchell, to not hold the PEP as a legitimate political category either, right? To say that this is not something that's sustainable or tenable. You can't be that, right? Any more than you can be progressive except for slavery, right? It's not a permissible position to be at. So what we decided to do is begin with the question that you're getting at, which is how do we arrive there? What are the conditions that allow for that to be? And for us, it's not a singular strategy. It's not a cabal of power. It's not a secret deal that people make. And it's not, as you point out, a conscious choice that sometimes people engage. There's a way that it's actually just the norm of American politics. And we wanted to get at some of the kind of structures, systems, logics, histories, institutional arrangements, et cetera, that get us there, that get us to a point where you can be a progressive member of Congress, and you can identify as liberal, radical, whatever, or literally progressive. How do you get to a space where you can be outraged at what's happening at the southern border, be outraged at the separation of families and children, the outrage at people being locked in cages, and say nothing about the cutting of UNRWA funds, or say nothing about what's happening in Gaza. I mean, how does that become a reconcilable or morally sustainable position for you? And we want to get at that and understand that it's not a singular cause. It's not. Again, part of it is just the norm of the day. And so we sort of examine how American politics gets to a place where Democrats and Republicans actually unify on this issue. You watch a debate between Trump and Hillary, or Trump and Biden, or whomever, and they'll disagree with everything from oil to offshore drilling to the environment to education, sometimes to reproductive justice. We can go down the list, and then you get to this question of Israel and Palestine, and suddenly they're singing the same note, have the same talking points. You know, you close your eyes. Which one first is going to say Palestinians could have had paradise, but they chose Hamas? Who's going to say that they need a Gandhi? Who's going to say, I mean, you can pick, right? It might be Hillary, it might be Donald. And so part of what we want to get is how we arrive at that place, so that the young activist understands that as they enter this sphere, that Palestine is something that should be on the table with everything else, but gets exceptionalized, right? And really, Israel gets exceptionalized. And as a consequence of that, Palestinian rights and Palestinian justice gets exceptionalized and marginalized. And so I think that the boundaries are, again, are institutional, they're cultural, they're political, they're all of these things. And we want to unpack them. And we split most of our time unpacking it at the policy level. But we could have just as easily written a book about how this plays out in terms of academia, right? We could unpack. I mean, you got a group of professors that will write letters about cancel culture, and some of them were the very people who fought to cancel Stephen Salaita, right? I mean, it's a bizarre way that they can reconcile that. Anyway, I don't want to keep going, but that's sort of some of the terrain. But you know,
so there's also I think for me a lot. I mean, I agree with everything Mark said, but for me there was another dimension that was about holding up a mirror. As Mark said, there's a debate. Even sometimes it's too shallow. Sometimes it's, you know, within a very narrow framework. But there's some kind of political debate on most issues in Washington. On this one, there's virtually none, and the reason is not because Republicans and people on the right are backing Israel. Actually, that's quite natural. I think the right-wing stance, the evangelical stance on Israel, is based on a certain, you know, for evangelicals, it's based on a certain interpretation of the Bible. For more secular people, it's based on a racist view of a racist and ethnocentric view of global politics. We can, you know, or just, you know, U.S. interests and not caring about human rights. We can make a whole list of why it makes sense. Among Democrats, you would think, based on other issues, that there would at least be a pull towards Palestinian rights in the party. And it's true, lately, you know, in the last few years now, we've seen some small steps. I mean, we see Rashida Tlaib get elected. We see Ilhan Omar get elected. We see, you know, the squad. We see Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren occasionally step out a little bit, although not nearly as much as they do on other issues. And I thought it was really important to hold a mirror up to that and to say, how is it that you have these views on every other issue and somehow this is acceptable? And I have, you know, having come from a very, very pro-Israel background, I have a certain perspective on why that might happen, how that might come to be. And I think that there's a way that Israel is viewed that makes it exceptional. I think there's a way that Palestinians have been perceived and portrayed in this country that creates all of those things. But the end result is this sort of illusion. And I felt like the place that our contribution as Americans was going to be most powerful was holding a mirror up to that illusion, that sense of unreality, that that view of Israel and Palestine and Israelis and Palestinians in a very almost caricaturish way, a very fictionalized way, a way that humanizes Israelis in a way we rarely see when we talk about other countries, and dehumanize Palestinians in a way that is a more extreme version of what I think we see, you know, in many places in Africa and Asia in particular, and also Latin America, any place that's basically people of color. It's an expression in many ways, I think, of white supremacy. And yet it's something that progressives, at least some segment of the progressive community, liberal to radical, upholds. And that isn't sustainable if we can hold that mirror up to them, and they really have to look at it in my, you know, at least I hope not.
Okay, well, I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate, right? So, because this, you know, Mark is right. There isn't a cabal. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's not that people have just been, you know, pushed into the corner out of fear. There's also a sincere belief, right, that Israel represents the culmination of light over darkness, that the idea of, you know, a state, a Jewish state, as a way to overcome anti-Semitism, state-sponsored anti-Semitism in the form of Nazism, right? The idea that Jews cannot be assimilated, that there is no other answer. And so that this is a culmination. And in fact, we know from a lot of Black, you know, radicals, not part of the Black radical tradition, but at least, you know, Black freedom fighters who were part of, insisted on Black liberation, saw Israel as a model. Mm-hmm. Of a particular form of emancipation. Obviously, this begins to crumble after 1967 and wasn't in consensus before the 1967 war. But let's just hold that and play devil's advocate, that there is a reason that people believe in that. And yet what you're telling us is they shouldn't, right, on the one hand. And then second, what you're saying very clearly is that Palestine is part of a broader human rights struggle for freedom and cannot be separated from it. So can you go into that to explain to readers, you know, folks should get the book and figure it out, but for those who want to learn more from you on why that is, how would you explain this to them?
You know, I think it's an important, and this is why we got some criticism for this, at least I did, for in the first chapter, or actually even in the introduction, we begin a few pages in, maybe four or five pages in, by talking about this question of anti-Semitism. Not because we want to equate Palestinian-ness or Palestinian struggles with anti-Semitism, because there is a way that, you know, the very idea of engaging in struggles for Palestinian freedom automatically invite a conversation with about anti-Semitism, which is unfair to Palestinians. And so we don't want to play into that. But it was very important for me and Mitchell to have a conversation about the legitimacy of those claims that the world is not only anti-Semitic, but maybe even increasingly so. And that there's a longstanding tradition, certainly in the era of right-wing Trump politics. Although those of us on the left and Black folk get tagged with the anti-Semitic labels, often actually it's the white evangelicals, it's the Trump folk who are pro-Israel and anti-Semites at the same time who actually stir a lot of this stuff up. Mm-hmm. But we want to acknowledge, look, anti-Semitism is real. Anti-Semitism is something that has been going on not just in current times, but in previous times, in earlier times. There's a long tradition of the hatred of our Jewish brothers and sisters. And so we want to acknowledge that. And we understand that. And the idea, to your point, of your devil's advocacy, of saying, you know, the formation of a Jewish state seems like the natural culmination of an attempt to redress that, to offer a space of safety and self-determination against the backdrop of the hell of Europe, against the hell of pogroms in Russia and Poland. I understand that. And the Black tradition, as you point out, from Garvey to
Du Bois,
you know, I think about Du Bois' letter in 48, you know, mm-hmm. the ethics and the question of Palestine, or his newspaper article, right? They also understood it, as you said, it was a model of possibility for what it meant to be a hated people people who are hated, subject to random violence, despised, what does it mean for them to find a space of self-determination and safety? Because whenever they've been a minority, an ethnic minority, they've been vulnerable, right? And they haven't gotten support from other folk. I get that. But what Garvey understood, what Du Bois understood, was that forming your own nation, right, identifying rather as your own nation, right, which is, you know, Zionism as the idea of a Jewish nation, right, and finding a physical space to live out the promise of nationhood is not problematic as such, although I would say I'm skeptical of the nation state, period. I don't care where it is, how it is. I'm saying the nation state as such is an act of violence, not just Israel. But I'm talking about the United States. I'm talking about Germany. I'm talking about New Zealand. I'm talking about Australia. I'm talking about all of them. But their issue was that they didn't understand exactly what was happening in 1882 up through, say, you know, that first Aliyah in 1904, right? For them, the formation of a Jewish state was fine because they didn't understand the impact it was having on the pre-existing population of Palestinians who were in that land. And so I would have the same argument now that they would have then, right? And this is what, as you said, post 67, the Black radicals understood even more in more sophisticated fashion, just because they had more access to information, because they could see what happened after the 1967 war. You know, there was even King in 68 could, you know, was saying, wait a minute, before I go back to the quote unquote Holy Land, I'm using quotes because that's what he wrote in the letter. I need to think about what's happening here. I'm skeptical of what's going on here. I'm no longer willing to go full force on this. And I don't think they're ever going to give East Jerusalem back, is what he said in particular. And so he was beginning to understand this as a political project that was more complicated and nuanced. The issue, take my skepticism of states off the table for a minute. The issue was not the formation of a Jewish state. The question was, how can we create a space of coexistence where, to quote a great scholar, Norda Ettekat, one relinquishes themselves of the desire to rule? That's the question. Of course I understand why there's a desire for a Jewish state. Of course I understand why the desire for safety, self-determination, peace, and dignity. Jewish people all around the world deserve that, just like everyone deserves that. The question is, how can we create that model that doesn't come at the expense of others? And what we try to get at in this book, in that first chapter around this question of right to exist, is how can we look at the impact? Forget about the philosophical conversations we could have about Zionism, but the impact of political Zionism, which has been the primary and most dominant iteration of Zionism. How can we look at the impact of that on Palestinian people and critique that in a way that doesn't dismiss the legitimacy of Jewish self-determination, but says, how can this play out in a way that actually provides safety, dignity, and self-determination for everybody? And to date, the current model does not work for everybody.
Yeah, I think, as a Jew, I look at it as, and someone who has actually spent a great many years studying the history of Zionism, Zionism set out to create a modern nation out of the Jewish people. And one of the things that happens when you create a modern nation is that history goes in two directions, right? You move on into the future. And as you move on into the future and the nation coalesces, the collective memory turns that group of people's history and makes it longer and longer. It goes back farther and farther. That's part of creating a nation. And so despite that, you know, Zionism was around for, you know, a good 75 years before the State of Israel and before it became a majority position among Jews. And I think that's kind of a key thing. And, you know, it's certainly open to debate whether it would have ever become a majority position among Jews if not for the Holocaust. And the Holocaust, I think, is something that we need to look at really, really carefully. Why then did so many turn to the idea of a Jewish state? Because I'm with Mark. I'm not a big fan of the nation state. And I don't necessarily think in my individual opinion that a Jewish state was the right answer to generations of Jewish suffering. That said, the decision to become to create a sort of national existence is a Jewish decision, as it is for any other group of people, any other nation. The boundaries of that is where it affects someone else, right? So we can have a question, and I think that Jews can debate, do we want to exist as a nation in the modern sense? And that is up to us. That ends where other, you know, another people's rights begin. And we can question whether or not, we can continue to question whether or not that existence was necessarily the best choice, but it was a choice. It was the choice that people made. Had Palestine been an unpopulated island, as myth had it, that it was, you know, a land without a people for people without a land, had that been true, I mean, what's the problem, right? The issue is not, colonizing empty land. The issue is colonizing land that has people on it, and what that does to their collective rights. So I think Zionism did, in many respects, I mean, I think Zionism was always kind of conscious of being a sort of European construct, and a construct that, I mean, there's no question. If you look back at the discussions among early Zionist thinkers in the 19th century and even the early 20th century, the colonialism there is clear, and it's embraced, and it's normal. You know, frankly, that was the view of much of liberal Europe at the time. So it was certainly not out of step with anything, you know, from the right to, you know, a land thousands of miles away to the whole white man's burden concept. It was all there. I don't necessarily see that as being all that different from a lot of nationalism at that time. The problem is that Jews actually resisted it, and it didn't become a majority position until after World War II, and by which time we had things like international laws and international, more, I think, frankly, more important, international norms. We were already starting to see the world decolonizing. So Israel was late to the game, as it were. And I think that turned Israel into a state that was saying, on the one hand, you know, look at our long, long history of need. Look at our long, long history of persecution. Don't we need something? And, you know, I think that's a fair thing to say. Yes, I think we did. I think, again, I don't know that was the right answer, but we certainly needed some kind of answer. As I've pointed out many times, the trauma of the Holocaust is not only that 6 million Jews died. It's not only that they were killed and that many others were tortured, and everyone who went through that was horribly, horribly traumatized. The collective effect was that Jews had a long history of that kind of persecution. Although the magnitude was certainly different, the other big difference was, before that incident, before the Holocaust, we could always go somewhere else. All of a sudden, in World War II, everyone was closing their doors. No one would take Jews in, despite the fact that most of the able-bodied men were off to war, right? The United States closed its doors, sent people back. You know, all the so-called liberal promise was broken when it came to Jews fleeing that persecution. So, you know, that's a collective trauma that people really identify with. In some ways, it's guilt, but in other ways, it's also, you know, hey, that was a really bad thing to do. So I think that all brings us to this place of sympathy, and I think that's where most people have started up until now. I think only in recent years do you really have people coming into this with a consciousness of the crimes Israel has committed and the amount of dispossession that its creation, not only its creation, but its sustenance and its growth have necessitated. It could not have been created in the way it was without dispossessing the Palestinian people. It could not have grown as it has, economically, politically, and certainly militarily, without further dispossessing the Palestinian people, occupying the Palestinian people, denying the Palestinian people their rights. And despite the many, many, many centuries and more recent horrors of Jewish suffering, that doesn't make that okay. It doesn't make that acceptable. And it shouldn't, you know, but I do think it does change the question of Israel for a lot of people it makes it much more complicated because, you know, it's the quote-unquote victims becoming the victimizers. And you can only really see that if you understand that they have become the victimizers. And I think we're still at the stage where a lot of people need to really understand that Israel, you know, in many cases, you know, there's many Israelis who I know, many who I love dearly and are wonderful, wonderful people and fight against this. But in the end, Israel as a collective has become a victimizer. And that is very hard for people to accept.
Yeah, I appreciate your forthcomingness to have this discussion. I think that these are that's part of the terrain where these things become landmines. And it's a lack of the ability to discuss it because of the sensitivities associated with it, that we even lack the tools and the language to be able to have what should otherwise be an obvious, explicit conversation. I just want to add a couple of things to what y'all said, especially, you know, for folks thinking about this, as Mitchell is raising for us, there is a perennial Jewish question, right? And there have been many responses to that question, from assimilation to, you know, labor struggle, including to various forms of Zionism, right? Mm-hmm. There isn't just one Zionism. To condemn all of it, I think, is what, you know, makes some people also sensitive, because there's a cultural Zionism that's in question that people do hold on to and actually were referring to, and a split between Zionist thinkers, and political Zionism, which we can refer to as Herzlian Zionism, that culminates in the establishment of the State of Israel, and which is predicated on the removal of Palestinians, and not merely a denial that there were a population there, but the denial that those that population constituted a political entity, a political community with the right to self-determination, in line with the colonial denial of people's sovereignty beginning in the 15th century. And the conquistadores, you know, exploration and conquest of the Americas, right? That this is in line with the theory of an empty land, terra nullius. It wasn't that there was actually empty, but that the people on it weren't, for racist reasons and, you know, international law reasons, could not be sovereign. But on the question of then what does Herzlian Zionism, in addition to, you know, exuding and meeting out this violence, what does it mean for, you know, when people want to tell us, but Jews have a right to self-determination on that land. You know, here I just want to go back, and, you know, in addition to your general aversion to nationalisms, is also, you know, to hold on to this idea that this right isn't necessarily, you know, it's sometimes being equated with a biblical right that is also a stand-in with somehow, you know, in an indigeneity. And the one thing I want to point out here is something that David Ben-Gurion, the, you know, two-time prime minister of Israel and one of its, you know, leading, you know, politicians and military persons, says very clearly, Israel is part of the Middle East in geography only. Right. So to claim a belonging and an indigeneity to a place that you reject, right? It's the creation of Israel to earn acceptance somewhere else, and primarily in Europe, that rejected it, is the thing that we can get to. And then I'll just end on that of, we should definitely embrace the Holocaust as you do as trauma. And one of the things that, you know, Professor Shireen Say'ali teaches us and teaches her students is to do that with radical empathy. So that the Holocaust and the Palestinian Nakba and the removal of Palestinians, which is an ongoing process, not, you know, a particular event, are not in antagonism, you know, are not in controversy with one another, but actually we have to hold those two things together. The Holocaust and the Nakba become traumas that we hold together, not distinct and mutually exclusive. And so that's kind of the radical work that we would need to do to overcome the limits amongst progressive politics on this question. So with that, I want to, Mitchell, I want to actually ask you this question, because I've known you for a long, long time. I've met you in different iterations of your political and intellectual journey. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been wonderful, right, to grow with you along the way in our respective fields. And when I can say, I think, and it's okay for me to say, that you too were once a PEP, a progressive except for Palestine. And I think it's really instructive for our audience to know about, you know, that pathway for you. You know, it's both a big leap, right? It's both that big leap of understanding that Israel is not unassailable, and then incremental leaps after that, to then go, well, even the limits of the two-state solution demonstrate themselves. Can you walk us through some of your journey?
Sure. I mean, I'm going to try and keep this brief because I'm old now and there'd be too much of that. But I mean, I was born into an Orthodox Jewish family in a very, very pro-Israel environment. I like to illustrate that by pointing out to people that when I was 11 on a Shabbat at a friend's house, I met Meir Kahana. So that I wouldn't say that is necessarily entirely typical of the environment, but that was certainly a significant part of the environment I was in. There's a part of the Israel narrative that I think is a landmine for the pro-Israel side, because it certainly in my case, I was, by the time I was entering my teens, I hadn't really questioned it, except to the extent that the story I was hearing was that every single time Israel was always innocent, Israel was always so good, it was always in the right. It basically never made a mistake. And if it did, well, it was really accidental. It didn't mean it. And Palestinians, well, actually, you know, at that time, we're talking about the late 70s and early 80s. So it was not the Palestinians. Palestinians were not generally referred to. It was the Arabs. So the Arabs were always evil and treacherous and like, and, you know, I was, you know, it didn't take long before I was like, that just doesn't make sense. Nobody's ever that much in the right. And that sort of started me on a journey. And actually the first place I went was to study Israeli history. And Israeli, you know, when Israelis were writing history, it wasn't actually that cut and dried as it was in terms of what I was being told as an American Jewish child. So that was sort of the first step. And over the years, more and more, you know, I learned. And, you know, a big shift for me, I mean, I got into progressive politics as a teenager, and I was active. I was active in the anti-apartheid movement, Central America at that time. I was pretty active with ACT UP and a whole bunch of different issues and causes. But I was definitely still pro-Israel throughout that time. I think a real break for me was the First Intifada. And I think that's probably true for a lot of Americans my age, because it was the first time that I would watch the news and hear the word Palestinian and not immediately after that hear the word terrorist. It really was a shift. Palestinians were humanized in mainstream culture at least a little bit for the first time in my lifetime. And see, you know, the little boy with the holding the rock, throwing, you know, against the tank, you know, that was a powerful image. And it was a powerful image on a number of levels. And when it came back to me that, you know, the Israeli strategy was break their limbs, you know, that sort of sounded to me like a lot of the things I was protesting here in the U.S. It still took a long time. I mean, I would say that the next big break for me was the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, which happened just as I was going at a relatively late age into my undergraduate study. And I went after that, and fortunately a mentor said wanted me to do a special project, and the special project was to read the entire Oslo Accords and summarize it, both Oslo I and Oslo II. And I did. And the first thing I wrote in my summary was, this cannot work. And the reason it couldn't work was that there was no attention paid to human rights. And this opened up a big world for me in terms of the politics around this issue. I started realizing there was no universalism here at all, ever. There was never universalism. Everything was talked about in terms of what do Israelis want, what do Palestinians want. And the American discourse was to listen to the Israelis and to ignore the Palestinians. There was absolutely no application of universal human rights or universal values of any kind. And that really started me on my journey. A few years after that, I joined Jewish Voice for Peace. And at that time, JVP was a small organization that met in people's living rooms at most a couple times a month in San Francisco and Berkeley. And a few years later, I was hired by them, and you know, have gone ever since. I think you know, for me, a lot of the journey has been personal, a lot of the journey has been political, and it's been about actually, you know, finding ways to match my politics, which are, you know, both idealistic, but also I'd like to think pragmatic. So that was tug of war for me for many years. You know, my focus was, I want to resolve this conflict. I want to find ways to resolve this issue. I want to find ways to create justice here, to create, you know, for a while I thought about peace, but I moved past peace because, well, whatever, it got to be kind of a dirty word in this realm, but justice and to me, justice is not about retribution, and it's not, you know, I tend to shy away from the concept of it as accountability. Rather, it's about, you know, creating a present and a future that allows everyone to live with the past. You know, and
that's beautiful.
Yeah, that actually does entail, to some extent, you know, some amount of retribution, I guess, or accountability, at least anyway. But given the politics around this, a lot of times I would go back and forth, and how do you fit that in with my ideals? And, you know, I think I'll always struggle with that to some degree. But I think for me, what crystallized was being an American ended up like sort of overriding everything else. So that was why for me, it was all about American policy. In this, not because American policy necessarily even is determinative, but because that's, as an American, that's what I can affect, and I can bring a consciousness of, you know, really caring and holding in my heart the value and lives of Israelis and Palestinians together. And fortunately, there's enough Israelis and Palestinians who also share that perspective that I can, yeah, I can sustain that.
And thank you for that offering also to highlight for us that justice doesn't necessarily mean accountability and retribution, because oftentimes what's lost, mm-hmm. actually most of the time what's lost can't be brought back.
Right.
And that harm can't be repaired. Right. So how do we create a world that is just for now, the past, and the future? We've got questions coming in from the audience. People are asking how does one combat these conditions and circumstances? What should one do? How do you, you know, fight more effectively to bring Palestine into the realm of progressive politics?
I think the how for me is a few things. Part of it is we have to literally make it a priority issue in terms of the electoral sphere, in terms of, you know, one of the things that is encouraging to me is that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, however limited their progressive politics were on the question of Palestine, they were far more advanced than they had been even 4 years prior, and certainly more advanced than everyone else who was a mainstream rival for the Democratic nomination. Whether we're ready to call him Amo Bernie or not is a whole other conversation, right? But at the very least, it was a politics that acknowledged the humanity of Palestinians and thought that they were at least worth a kind of policy shift that would at least consider Palestinian human rights as a legitimate concession for funding, right? Again, it's a drop in the bucket. It's the lowest of low bars. I'm not saying that that's where we want to be, but it was at least a signpost of what's possible. How does that become possible? It becomes possible when we make different political demands. Politicians don't have feelings, they have interests. And we have to find ways of leveraging whatever the issue is, our interests, to shift, to converge with the politician's interests, thinking about CRT, as such that the politician will make a different move. And so that means how we organize, how we vote. The fact that Rashida Tlaib, the fact that Ilhan Omar are in the Congress right now is a signpost, again, that it's possible, but that with the right support, Palestine doesn't have to be disposable. That's the sort of electoral sphere. I think we need a framework, and this is partly my academic brain, but it's also, I think, how we move people on the ground, is we need to have a politics of solidarity that doesn't hinge on sameness, but that does acknowledge common systems, frameworks, etc., that put us in positions that render us vulnerable. When we think about Ruth Wilson Gilmore's work and this idea of being vulnerable or susceptible to premature death, and letting that vulnerability or susceptibility be the kind of signpost of racism, right? In other words, that racism as a system is one that consigns people of a certain sort, of a certain identity category, that makes them more vulnerable to premature death. Well, now as a Black person in America, I can say that being Black makes me more likely to get COVID, makes me more likely to die of COVID. And again, I'm not making an ontological claim or biological claim that Black people out of the womb are more likely to get COVID. What I'm saying, of course, is a set of social circumstances that connect, that correlate to Blackness, are what make me more likely to die. That's why Black people are dying more of this. We pay more for insurance. We even with the same you know, credit score. We work harder for less money. We go to prison more. We get arrested. Every index of social misery, we're at the top. Every measure of social prosperity, we're at the bottom. And so, in that sense, this is a way of seeing the relationship between my Blackness in this context, in the United States context, and our suffering and our misery. And so, if I think about the ways, again, that within the context of say the Israeli state, just talk about Palestinians who live inside of the state of Israel. And again, I'm not saying that to separate Palestinians in the West Bank or Gaza or in exile, because one of the worst things I think we can do is separate those struggles. And again, one of the dangers of Oslo, which we get at a little bit in the book, but we could talk about more, is that it kind of rendered different people to be of different sorts. But I'm saying, if I just look at those conditions and I say, well, you know, to be Palestinian in the state of Israel means that I'm less likely to get a high quality education, less likely to be able to access the neighborhood that I want to live in vis-a-vis admissions boards and things like this, right? That I'm less able to, and we're going down the list of things, what am I more susceptible to? Then we can begin to see commonalities in our struggle, not sameness. But I'm saying that part of how we can get this issue more in line in the States is if we understand that we're both engaged in an anti-racist struggle. And framing the struggle as an anti-racist struggle, as a struggle where the identities that we embody are the thing that makes us more vulnerable to social misery. To understand that as a common struggle is a way to attach as a framework. So it's not this exotic abstract idea that there's some Palestinians who are unfree and they're dealing with catching hell, and I don't exactly understand it. But having that link, right? This is part of what made South Africa an interesting connection, an interesting link, right? But it's not just tactical, right? That's why I say it's not just about sameness, because you could tactically say, that's why I don't like when people say, oh, there's Afro-Palestinians, there's Black people over there. No, there's something more sophisticated in here. The other thing is, we can't dismantle these systems. We literally need each other. And part of the political education that comes from the work we're doing is that we need to make it clear that in order to get free here in the United States, in order to get free in Palestine, that we have to understand that there are common systems and structures. Some of them are discursive, right? Some of them are material that shape our realities and that undermine our ability to get self-determination and justice and freedom. And I'm not just saying this to be like kumbaya, but Israelis also can't get free until these things happen, right? Our Jewish brothers and sisters can't get free until everyone is free. Again, it's not just a lefty cliche. We are interdependent. We are bound up in each other's, as Gwendolyn Brooks say, we are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond. That's, for me, that is a political analysis as well. And so for me, the way to make this, just to sum that up, because I know I did a lot of talking, is to say we need to do electoral work. We need to force politicians to do more, but we also need a conceptual framework and a political analysis that demonstrates how we're connected so that we're not just locked at the arm, but locked at the circumstance.
It's also really notable that, you know, for many years we heard how, you know, well, we need Israel because of the Cold War. We need Israel because of the, you know, all the hostile Arab states, which are now, you know, all U.S. allies. We need, you know, all these reasons. There's no longer any of that. The only real rationale that anyone ever talks about now about in terms of, you know, quote unquote, pro-Israel, Hasbara propaganda is the unbreakable bond, the special relationship. That is and that means the only real defense is not an argument. It is the hurling of invectives. And it is therefore the only real tool that people have now if they want to defend what has become an increasingly indefensible policy. of supporting Israel as it completely denies people their freedom and their rights and their hope. The only thing you can do is call that that very assessment anti-Semitic. There really isn't anything left. In a sense, it's desperation, but it is a devastating weapon, and it can have really, really horrible implications. You know, one thing that every time we do these talks, somebody asks, you know, well, how do we engage in this without being called anti-Semites? And my answer is, you don't. You don't. And you have to be ready for that. You're going to be called an anti-Semite. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish. Okay, believe me, it doesn't matter if you're Jewish. You're going to be called an anti-Semite because that's what that, especially now, that's all they have. That really is. I mean, that and, you know, that and simple falsehoods. You know, the recent controversy over Israel's refusal to vaccinate Palestinians in the occupied territories, which is, you know, clearly their responsibility under the Geneva Convention. And by the way, their excuse that the Oslo Accords frees them from that responsibility is false. It's not only false because the Oslo Accords can't supersede the Geneva Conventions, but the Oslo Accords actually don't say that. They actually say Israel is still responsible for this. That, okay, it actually commits Israel to work with the Palestinians to make sure that an epidemic is controlled. That's actually in the Oslo Accords. So that, even if that invalid argument was not invalid, right? So it would still not work. So the dishonesty there is, I think, really important, and it's what. You know, it's really what they have, because fundamentally, what are we saying here? You're defending the idea that a country has a right to hold millions of people without any rights for generations, to dispossess people and not ever let them see their homeland again for generation upon generation? Is that really what you're defending? Again, we don't defend that in any other realm except for Palestine. So, you know, when people ask me, you know, how do I not get called an anti-Semite? You're going to get called an anti-Semite because that's all they got. That really is ultimately all they've got, and it's effective. So, and how do you counter it? Well, you counter it by making sure that, you know, you're acting on principle. You know, anti-Semitism as well as racism, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia, et cetera, the whole list. We as progressives are against all of them. And if we are, you know, if we say that we are against all of them, we are working for justice writ large, that one of those issues is not more important than another. That's how you counter it. And that, I believe, I think for most of us, is the world we're trying to build.
Hey, hey, I like this world. what concepts of actually eradicating all forms of isms and not forgetting one, kind of coming full circle to where we started in the work of some radical Arab American feminists. So congratulations again, Mark and Mitchell. May you continue to spread the good word, and may we build justice together.
Yes, may you, please. Thank you so much, Noura. Thank you.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
If you made a compensation claim for abuse at an Indian residential school, the records of your claim are secure. They will be destroyed in September 2027 unless you choose to keep them or share them. To learn more, call toll-free 1-877-635-2648 or go to myrecordsmychoice.ca.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Tonight, sweetie, I'm making you your favorite meal. It's the least I can do after an entire week of taking away your phone, going through your messages, calling you names, insulting your friends, and shouting at you. Yeah, tonight, I'm making you your favorite meal so I can start another week of taking away your phone, going through your messages, calling you names, insulting your...
Violence against women stops here. Contact SOS Violence Conjugale. A message from the government.
And her talking, yeah. Something deep down my soul cried,
cry.
When I saw you and her walking. But I'd rather go blind. I see you walk away from me. You see, I love you so much, I just don't want to watch you leave. And most of all, I just don't want to be free. I was just sitting here thinking about it.